Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Hi, everybody. Hope you're having a good weekend, and thank you for joining me on a Saturday afternoon. So welcome. Thanks. Today, we're somewhat going to continue the show from yesterday. By the way, I'm open to suggestions, comments about, I've got a new camera. I think it looks better. Maybe play around with settings and stuff. So any suggestions would be cool if you have any. Those are, particularly those of you who know something about cameras. It's the Sony something X105V5, whatever. Anyway, we're going to continue from yesterday, and we are going to answer a bunch of questions. I've got a whole list of questions, and take super chat questions on YouTube and do all that. I will also be I've got a couple of super chat questions from a week ago that I need to catch up on. And that's what I'm going to start off with. And then we're going to go to the Patreon contributor questions. And again, reminder, if you want to be able to vote on those questions, if you want to have a say on which questions that I answer, if you want to propose questions, then please become a Patreon contributor. One of the perks of being a contributor is that. Also, just a reminder, for those of you who have not subscribed to my YouTube channel, please subscribe and tell your friends and share and do all those fun things. All right, so let's start right off the bat. This is a question from a Brazilian listener, and who I was in Brazil, and he's asking about a real difficult situation right now in Brazil. So since you're here in Brazil, this was when I was in Brazil, have you seen the Venezuela border migrant situation? It is producing some Trump-like reactions, blaming migrants instead of the incompatibility of our welfare state and free movement, freedom for that matter, some high-level cognitive dissonance. So yeah, so just to give you a sense of what's going on in Brazil and on the Venezuela border between Venezuela and Brazil, is that, you know, Venezuelans are fleeing. They're getting out of Venezuela. Socialism in Venezuela has collapsed. People are starving. It's been collapsing for a few years. It's reached a critical situation where people literally don't have food. And as a consequence, they are fleeing. They're leaving Venezuela. They're leaving Venezuela primarily to Colombia, where they are, I've seen some estimates of 2 million refugees from Venezuela are now camped out in Cambodia. And about 60,000 of them cross the border into Brazil. Into a northern segment of Brazil, a northern segment which is quite poor, very poor actually, and where people are really struggling to deal with them. What do you do with these people? They're coming in, they don't have anything. Brazil is in economic crisis right now. It's not like they are just waiting jobs for them. The Brazilians themselves are struggling economically. This particular area is particularly poor, so it would be different, I think, if they were migrating in from the south into the wealthier segments of Brazil, where there are more jobs, there's more economic activity, and there's no wealth to go around. I also find it curious, not really, if you think about it, that like global aid organizations are not there to help these refugees. They seem to, it's always a big, you get all these big messages and big fundraising goals, you know, when there's a when something hits Haiti or when there's something big in Africa, you know, there's this big effort around raising money to help the refugees. And it's tragic what is happening to these people. I mean, the government has basically destroyed the country and they are suffering the consequences. So it's curious that you're not getting massive aid going down there. But of course, I think the main reason for that is that to some extent, the aid organizations don't want to admit and certainly don't want to advertise. And I don't think there's an appetite out there for people to contribute to the victims of socialism. People will contribute to the victims of war, to the victims of famine, to the victims of, you can couch it. Of course, all of those to some all of those, to some extent at least, are consequences of statism and collectivism and tribalism in most regions in the world. They're happy to contribute to victims of natural disasters, but to contribute to victims of socialism, you know, it's interesting. Just I'll note that I haven't seen any campaign to raise money for the people in fleeing Venezuela to these places. So what is a country to do when a neighboring country basically collapses and millions of people, or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, just flee all at once from that country? And I've actually addressed this in a number of different places when we've discussed immigration, certainly when I discussed the mass migration into Europe. Certainly in situations like that, government has a role in stopping this mass migration, in controlling it. Think about it in the context of, put aside the welfare state and everything else, think about it in the context of a laissez-faire, completely free market. And let's say Brazil was Colombia is more likely. Let's say Colombia was a laissez-faire capitalist country. All the land is privately owned. And suddenly 2 million people stream across the border. Well, where are they going to live? Whose land are they going to squat on? How are they going to get from point A to point B without violating property rights? It's inconceivable that a government would just stand back and say, yeah, sure, you can come across here. But by definition, by coming across, they would violate property rights. They haven't been invited. It's not like a healthy, normal migration where people come in to get a job, to come and work, and or invited by friends, family, associates, people who know them, to come, and where there's some path for them to get from point A to point B, and where there's some path ultimately for them to make a living for themselves. This is millions of people fleeing one place in order to pitch tents in another place. And a government should stop that. It is inappropriate. Now, certainly humanitarian groups can rent land and set up tent camps to help these people, preferably on the side of the border from where they come from. There are all kinds of things that can and should be done from a humanitarian charity perspective. But the government would stop such mass migration, would vet the people coming in, would vet them for whether they are going to get a job, whether they have somebody where to stay, whether they have somebody to stay with, whether they have money to pay for a hotel room, whether they have money to pay for a cab or bus. You can't just have people wandering in and starting to walk through private property. So the test case is always laissez-faire, right? The test case is always laissez-faire. And if in a laissez-faire economy, in a laissez-faire world, there would be some control over people crossing the border when there is a situation like this, a civil war like in Syria, or a complete collapse of an economy like in Venezuela, absolutely the government should station basically troops at the border and control the flow in. I'm not saying it should zero out the flow in, but it should make sure that the people coming in are not going to be violating the rights of the people inside by trespassing or by just dying in the streets, starving in the streets. And I think then humanitarian organizations would set up, as I said, camps on one side or another of the border to take care of these refugees, and they should be viewed as refugees, not as immigrants. So now add on top of that, the fact that Brazil is a welfare state, the fact that Brazil is a struggling economy, it can't take care of these people. It doesn't have jobs for these people. There's a complete welfare state. As I said, my solution in a mixed economy to immigration, to my desire to have more immigrants rather than less immigrants, but wanting not to create, you know, massive new welfare recipients, is to limit immigration to those people who can find a job. I think that is a huge step forward towards more freedom. as we dismantle the welfare state, we can loosen up those reins as well. But at least while the welfare state, that's a good way of doing it, including laws that would prohibit people from receiving welfare if they came in as immigrants. Since there are no jobs in Brazil, or again, since the situation is such that people are just crossing the border, they're not looking for work, then I think Brazil needs to put a stop to it, to monitor it, to make sure that the people coming in are getting jobs. And I would hope that humanitarian organizations will go in there, charitable organizations would go in there and help the people at the border. But, you know, it's actually more urgent in Colombia than it is in Venezuela. And I think at the end of the day, that's the solution for Europe. And that's the solution Europe came to, in a sense, by bribing Turkey to keep the refugees in Turkey and to put them in tent cities and treat them as refugees rather than treat them as immigrants. So that would be my condition. I'm not going to blame the Venezuelans here. The Venezuelans are fleeing a horrible situation. Anybody should try to flee to the extent that they can. And the more honest, better ones are going to try to get a job in Brazil. They're not going to rely on the welfare state in order to survive in Brazil. So, it's a really, really difficult situation. Okay, as somebody's got a super chat question, although I have no idea what this currency is. I don't know if it's like 50 cents or $50 or SEK. What is SEK? What currency? All right. What is your take on Mexico's current political and economic situation, specifically with the election of a leftist candidate as the new president? Mexico is doing pretty well economically. It's been creating significant jobs. Unemployment in Mexico is relatively low. The economy has been growing over the last decade or so. It's in many ways done better than the U.S. economy. It's why, many people have argued. I've argued that immigration from Mexico has been negative since 2007, really, into the United States. That is, more Mexican Americans have gone back to Mexico than new Mexicans have come to the United States. Illegal immigration, the number of illegal immigrants in the United States has shrunk from 2007 till today. And this is why the whole Trump phenomenon and the whole obsession with illegal immigration is so, you know, bewildering, put it that way. Because there is no illegal immigration problem, certainly not from Mexico, maybe from other Central American countries. But Mexico actually has had a negative migration. People are going back to Mexico. So Mexico's economy has been good. Not great, right? Could be much, much better. Not great, but good. What do I make of the election of the new leftist candidate as new president? You know, we'll see what he does, right? Leftist candidates, I'm not big on left-right. I know right-wing candidates who have done more damage than leftist candidates who come in and turn out to be, relatively speaking, pro-markets. You know, I think in the big picture, Bill Clinton did a lot less damage to the U.S. economy than George W. Bush. This leftist candidate has promised that a lot of the reforms that were implemented by the previous presidents, that were pro-market reforms, are going to stay intact. He ran on a relatively pro-business agenda, a pro-freedom for business agenda. We'll see. I don't know. Now, he also promised massive increases to social spending, which I don't think he can do. So let me put it this way. I see no evidence that he is a Chavez, Maduro-like candidate who is going to take Mexico to the brink like Venezuela was, right? And if he is, and if Mexico collapses and becomes like Venezuela and millions of Mexicans suddenly show up on the U.S. border, then I'll be a lot more sympathetic to having a fence there, although I don't think a fence is a solution, but I'd be a lot more sympathetic to it. But that's not the situation. It ain't happening. Anyway, so that's my take on the new Mexican president. I mean, he's not going to be good, I don't think, but he's not going to be a complete and utter complete disaster. All right. By the way, if you want to ask questions, I see some people asking questions on Facebook. Go to YouTube, put your money where your mouth is, and ask a super chat question. That's the way to do it. You want questions? You either do it through Patreon, where because you're a contributor, you get your questions answered, or you do it through Super Chat. All right. Let's see. We got one more question here, and then I'm going to go to the Patreon contributor questions. What is your opinion on Candace Owens? And I don't know what this with Brett Weinstein. I'm not sure what that refers to. I don't know whose discussion with Brett Weinstein. Did Candace Owens have a discussion with Brett Weinstein? I don't know. So, Katie, if you're listening, enlighten me about what your question is. My opinion of Candace Owens, I mean, it's mixed. Generally, she's obviously very brave, very articulate, very smart. I think ignorant of a lot of issues, wrong on a lot of issues, conservative, so wrong on a lot of issues, but incredibly brave. She's a black woman standing up to the status quo, standing up to many people within her, quote, community, breaking stereotypes, which is fantastic and great. I think she buys into the whole conservative package without having the knowledge to really buy into it. So she says stuff without really knowing. She's not very well studied and well educated as much as I think she should be. And I think she will. I think she's getting there. She's getting much better. But again, very articulate, very brave, clever, smart. I think interesting. I just wish she wasn't conservative. You know, we need women like that who are objectivist. Hey, come on, guys. Where are you? Come on, gals, I should say. We need more gals like Candace Owens in objectivism. Right? I don't know what this with Brett Weinstein, but I think I can say that it's looking really good for me to have a sit down with Brett Weinstein and Dave Rubin live, and with a live audience. So it looks like I will be sitting down with Dave Rubin and Brett Weinstein in October on I think it's the 13th of October. It's the day after the Ayn Rand Institute Gala. So it'll be in New York in Manhattan. So I hope a lot of you can come. I think it'll be a terrific event. Get to see Dave Rubin. Dave Rubin's always good, and Brett Weinstein. It should be interesting. It might be Eric. It might be Eric that I'm sitting down with. I think it is Eric. So Eric Weinstein, one of the Weinstein brothers, right? They're interchangeable. Not really. Of course, they're not interchangeable. But we're going to be sitting down. I think it's with Eric, who is more. He's in finance, and he's. I think that conversation is going to be really interesting. So yes, I encourage you all to come. We will be live streaming it on the Ayn Rand Institute live stream page, and I'll be putting it up on my channel. And of course, you should come and watch it live, and you should come to the gala the night before. Make a couple of days in New York of it. Make a trip, come out and help contribute to the growth of the Ayn Rand Institute under its new CEO, Tal Tzfani, and then come and see the event with one of the Weinsteins, I think Eric, and me and Dave Rubin. So we have a lot of kind of exciting events coming up. We're looking at Douglas Murray in London in a couple of weeks, right? Soon, right? On the 21st of September. We're looking at Weinstein. Eric Weinstein in a few weeks after that in New York. And there is reason to believe, or at least hope, that we're going to have a sit down with Ben Shapiro. it might actually happen finally after much, I know prodding from some of you guys, but we're in discussions. Possibly it looks now like I will fly out to LA to sit down with Dave Rubin and Ben Shapiro, maybe in early December sometime. So it's getting on the calendar, which is hard to get anything on my calendar, hard to get anything on Ben Shapiro's calendar, hard to get anything on Dave Rubin's calendar, who's out traveling with Peterson, and almost impossible to pin down. So, we will do Douglas Murray, Weinstein, Shapiro, and who knows? There's probably more to come. So, more of these kind of events, more conversations, more discussions, more debates, more trying to get objectivism exposure with the audience of the intellectual dark web, with bigger and bigger audiences, intellectual audiences, which is my main goal, is to get Ayn Rand's ideas exposure among thinking individuals, right? So, all right, everybody has a favorite. Shane says the conversation with Weinstein is the one that matters. Douglas Murray, I think, is pretty phenomenal, so I'm looking forward to that conversation. And, of course, Ben Shapiro will just be fun and, of course, has the largest following of anybody, so bigger than Dave Rubin. So just having a video out there with me and Ben Shapiro will get huge exposure. So which conversation matters the most? It doesn't matter. We're going to do them all. We're going to do them all, and we're going to try to make them interesting and good. All right, let's jump into, and I'm warning you in advance, to some economic topics. And I don't know if Dan Weishart is listening right now. Are you on Facebook or on YouTube or on Blog Talk? If you're there, it would be great. If you're not, you're just going to have to listen to tape. But these are your questions. And one of them is a little tricky, so I'm not exactly sure what you're asking. So I'm going to try to figure out what it is that you're asking and answer the question that I think is of interest, and maybe expand a little bit, because I think your question – I actually didn't know what the question meant. That's how ignorant I am. So I went and did a little bit of research, and it's actually really – there's a lot of interesting stuff being written about it, so it's cool. It's cool. All right. So we're going to do 1, 2, 3 economics questions. And if we have time, I want to answer a question on the Me Too movement. If we don't have time, then we'll push the Me Too movement to tomorrow. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern time, another Yaron Brook show. I'm spoiling you with shows. Hope you appreciate it. You know how to express your appreciation. So we'll be running another show tomorrow. Okay, let's see. Okay, here's the question. The question is, and I'm curious how many of you know what he's talking about. Comment on, and I don't know how to pronounce this guy's name. I should know because he's a famous economist. Baumol. Baumol, he's a famous economist who died like 2 years ago at the age of 95. Baumol's cost disease and the supposed threat of technological job destruction. Okay, so let's take this slowly, right? Let's start with, what is Baumol's cost disease, and why is it even called the cost disease? Why is there a cost associated with it? One of the things that Baumol identified or presented is the idea. So, let's backtrack. In classical economics, the idea is, you get paid based on how productive you are. And as your productivity increases, as you can make more widgets with the same amount of time, with the same amount of effort, you become more valuable, and therefore your wages go up. But what happens to professions in which productivity does not increase? And yet, the wages seem to go up anyway, because if they didn't go up, what would happen to the workers in those professions? They would shift to other professions where they could make more money. And the example presented, one of the examples presented was of a, and this is from, I guess, Bumal's original paper, is of a violin quartet, right? A violin quartet by Mozart. The quartet plays that quartet, and it takes it 40 minutes to play. And it took it 40 minutes to play it in 1900. It took it 40 minutes to play it in 1800. And it takes it 40 minutes to play it today. From the perspective of the time it takes to play the quartet, productivity has not increased. And yet, we're not paying the violinists. There's a violinist, a cellist, a violists. We're not paying them what we paid them in 1900. Because if we pay them that little, there is a price at which, as much as they love playing the quartet, they would switch and go and actually, you know, do something else where productivity has increased and where therefore wages have gone up substantially. Do you get the issue here? Right? All right? So what happens is that some professions see wage, or broader speaking, costs increase in spite of the fact that that productivity has not. And the question is, why? Why does that happen? And is that a problem? And here's one way to think about the problem. If this is true, if this is all true, and I think there's something to it, but it's complicated. But we're answering complex economic questions on this show, all right? So the idea is that as we become wealthier, and this I think relates to the technological job destruction idea that Daniel is talking about, as we become wealthier, as we become more productive, then it becomes easier and easier and easier for us to satisfy our material needs. So it becomes easier and easier and easier to have a TV and a computer and a cell phone and a home and a car and all of these kind of products. And we start spending more and more and more money on things that have not shown an increase in productivity, like education, and we'll talk about that. Healthcare, we'll talk about that. Art, the quartet, right? We spend more and more and more. There's more and more demand for the quartets, in spite of the fact that the quartet itself is, quote, not more productive. Because if we measure their productivity by how many notes per second they produce, right? So, but we're consuming more and more quartets. We're consuming more and more music because we have more and more time. So the cost there, the wages are going up and the costs are going up. Now, you know, so what this does is, because we're spending more and more and more money on areas where productivity growth is slower than everywhere else, right? Slower than everywhere else, then what is happening is that generally economic growth is slower and generally productivity growth is slower because less energy is going into those areas where productivity growth is fast, like in technology, and more effort is going into those areas where where productivity growth is slow or negative, like education, right? All right? So you can start seeing that this is part of the explanation people have for why we have low growth rates in the world, in the U.S. today, and why we have low increases in productivity in the U.S. today, because more and more and more money is being spent in those areas that follow the Baumol cost disease. That is, that where productivity cannot or has not or will not increase because of the nature of the profession, education, healthcare, and again, we'll get to the specifics of all of those. Now, on top of that, just in the connection of technological job destruction, one of the arguments against the idea that robots are going to take all of our jobs and we're all going to be unemployed is exactly this idea, is the fact that over time, we are going to be doing fewer and fewer and fewer jobs that actually produce widgets, that actually produce stuff. We are moving towards a post-manufacturing era, and we're going to be doing more and more and more services. Again, services are considered more Baumol disease products because productivity, it's harder to increase productivity. We'll talk about whether that's true or not in a minute. So as it is absolutely true that as robots take more and more and more jobs away from manufacturing, jobs away from even from some of the technology jobs, we will have more and more and more time, more and more and more money to purchase the kind of products that only, at least for now, only human beings can provide, which is a variety of services under the services of a phenomenal chef, the services of a great masseuse, the services of a nail salon, the services of a great professor who's going to teach us something. We'll spend more time educating ourselves. The services of, more healthcare. Services of a personal trainer, right? So robots free us up to do, and there'll be more jobs associated with those things, right? There'll be more jobs associated with those things. So as technology advances, as manufacturing declines, not because it's moved abroad, manufacturing has not moved abroad. That is completely wrong. We produce more stuff in America today than we ever have before. There's more manufacturing in the U.S. than there was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 40 years ago. The reason that there's nobody working in those jobs is that computers have replaced them. Computers and robots and processes have replaced them. Okay. So my view is robots are not a threat for exactly this reason. Now, I don't think Baumol's cost disease applies here because I think there's an aspect of what's going on here that's true. It's true that at the margin, you might not be able to find people to do a particular task at a low wage because of the opportunities that they have. And therefore, you have to raise their wages, not because they have become more productive, but because other realms in the economy have become more productive. But I also think that we view productivity here as way too narrow, way too narrow a sense, right? I don't think of a quartet as the productivity of the quartet as the number of notes it generates, right? Or the time it takes it, because the time is fixed. The product is fixed. There's no way to efficiency gains that can be created with Mozart's quartet. It is what it is. It's done. It's fixed. You can't play faster. Then if you do, it's not Mozart's quartet. It's something else. But what has increased dramatically in terms of efficiency and cost to consumer has gone down, and yet consumption has gone up, which justifies the increased wages of these players. Well, what has is the availability of the quartet to listeners. In the past, if you ran a quartet in the 1900s, well, yeah, in the 1800s, the 19th century, then you were limited to the number of people who could fit in a salon or in a concert hall in terms of the number of people you could get to. And your wage was capped, not by the number of notes you play. That's silly. It's a silly way to think of it. But by the number of the people who could listen to your notes, the number of people who could benefit from what you were generating. And that was capped, right? But with the invention of record players and records, and then the invention of CDs, and now the invention of the internet and iTunes and streaming and everything else, there is no cap to the number of people who will listen to you. In a sense, the productivity of music and music delivery and accessibility has gone like that, has increased dramatically. So I don't think the way to think about it, well, as Kuda Baba, I think his name is, mentions, I shouldn't forget 8-track tapes. I think she thinks 8-track tapes was a step backwards in terms of the productivity. But productivity in the context of a quartet needs to be measured in the context of the cost of somebody having access to the music, somebody actually listening to the music. That's the value. The music doesn't have a value in and of itself. So, well, I think it has a value in and of itself. It's the music being listened to that produces a value, right? And the reason productivity has increased is because the market has expanded dramatically into billions of people. So, you know, I'm not sure how much Baumol's cost disease as a phenomena really applies, because I think if we think about productivity gains in a broader, wider sense, then you can see that productivity is enhanced across the entire economy. And that how we measure productivity, how we think about productivity might have to change. But it's not that people are free riding off of the productivity gains of other professions. The productivity gains of other professions have made it possible for more people to listen to your music, which in that sense enhances your productivity. Now, I'm not saying this phenomena doesn't exist, because at the margins it will exist. At least it kind of grows, because productivity doesn't all advance at once through different professions. It grows in growths and in spurts and stops and stalls. And you might see situations where productivity has not increased in a particular sector, but you still have to pay employees more in that sector because otherwise they would leave and go do some other work. Now, there's a whole other issue here, and that is the issue of, and I saw a number of articles on this. Why is it that we have not seen productivity increases in things like education and health, and primarily education and health? There's also a debate about housing and some others, right? Is this a cost disease where we're seeing costs go up and up and up and up, and then productivity is flat, maybe in some cases flat, potentially declining? So where's the money going? Right? Part of the question is, if the cost of education is going up and up and up and up, where's the money going? Because we're not getting a better product. At least, it's not obvious we're getting a better product, right? How you measure what a better product is again, a problem in economics, a problem that economics really has, right? But where's the cost going? Are salaries going up? It turns out, not really. So, for example, in education, teacher and professor salaries are not dramatically up. So why is the cost of education going up so much, right? Put aside government. What about private universities. Cost of education is going up and up and up and up. Profits are not going up. And the salaries are not going up. The number of professors is not going up. The number of professors is not going up. Where does the money go? Same with healthcare. Now, healthcare, again, it's very difficult to measure productivity, right? We spend more and more and more and more and more money on healthcare. Life expectancy is increasing, but nowhere near the rate of increase in the money we spend. Other countries, by the way, spend less than us and life expectancy higher. But there the problem is life expectancy the right measure? What about quality of life? Has quality of life increased to in parallel to the increase in costs? Do we live healthier lives today? I think we do. But is that a consequence of the rising cost or because we take the rise in expenditures on healthcare or because we take better care of ourselves? Where does all that money go in healthcare, in education? And if you study it, the money goes into the bureaucracy. So for example, in education, the money doesn't go, as I said, to professors. It doesn't go to smaller class sizes. It doesn't go to profits. It goes to a massive, massive increase in administrators. Massive, massive numbers of deans and vice deans and vice deans and deans for this and deans for that. And that's one. And the second, it goes to increases in facilities, in the quality of the physical space. And whether that's a value and whether that enhances productivity, whether that is enhancing the educational experience is a question. But a huge amount of money today is spent rather than on improving educational outcomes on more and more administrators and on nicer and nicer buildings, which don't necessarily generate better outcomes, people who are better positioned to deal with the world of work, right? With the challenges that they face in the world around them. So it all goes to the salaries of administrators, of bureaucrats, the same thing with healthcare. It all goes to the salaries of middlemen, of the various levels of insurance and regulations and controls. And at the end of the day, all these cost increases have to do with government regulations. Because if you had real, or another way to think of it, all of them are product of a decrease in competition. There's no competition in education. There's no competition in healthcare. And as a consequence, prices go up and up and up. Quality doesn't change. In other words, productivity goes down. Productivity goes down. And it's really interesting. I was reading something by John Cochrane, one of my favorite economists in the world. And Cochrane was saying, you know, it's kind of stunning that we can become less productive. How does that happen? How do we become less productive? It's almost like we lose knowledge. And it's rare in history that an economy becomes less productive. Venezuela is a good example of an economy becoming less productive, losing knowledge, losing the ability to produce. And I would argue that in healthcare, to some extent, but in education, to a large extent, we are becoming less productive. We are losing knowledge. In order to produce a student with X amount of knowledge today, we need 20 bureaucrats, whereas 20 years ago or 100 years ago, we only needed one. That is a massive decline in productivity. An increase in the amount of employment in non-productive activities. Bureaucracy created within universities because of regulation, because regulation has created an incentive to do so. There's some fascinating graphs about how the cost of anything government touches, anything that is regulated heavily, have go up, 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 up. And the costs in the marketplace of things, when you have very little price inflation, or when you have, let's put it this way, very little growth in the money supply or measured growth in the money supply, things don't increase in price. They actually decline in price. Things get cheaper. It's only those things that get expensive are the things that get expensive because there's loss of productivity. And the loss of productivity is because of the way an organization is structured. It's because of the regulation that impose costs. It's because businesses become less efficient because of their regulations, and that drives costs up. And you can see that in education, and you can see that in healthcare. Anyway, I don't know if I ever answered Daniel's question, but he will have to let me know. I said a lot about Beaumont's cost disease. There's a lot more to say about it. It's interesting. It's people attribute too much to it. I don't think they think through the real consequences of what's going on in the economy, particularly with regulations, to really get a deep understanding, to really understand what's going on from an economic perspective. I highly recommend reading two sources. One, Marginal Revolution, which is Tyler Cowen's website, which always has fascinating stuff on economics and what's going on. It's marginalrevolution.com. The other one is The Grumpy Economist. It's johncochran.blogshot.com, but The Grumpy Economist is the name of his blog. And two, Tyler Cowen has a number of different people blogging there, but excellent, excellent, excellent commentary on economic issues that I strongly recommend. Again, John Cochran is also excellent. Very different schools of thought. Marginal Revolution, more Austrian, and Grumpy Economist, more Chicago. Both super smart and super knowledgeable. All right, let's switch gears to another one of Daniel Weishart's questions. This one having to do with cryptocurrencies. And his question is simple. Will cryptocurrencies bring the downfall of fiat currencies? Will cryptocurrencies bring the downfall of fiat currencies? I doubt it. I mean, I think fiat currencies are going to have a downfall. I think that downfall is going to be caused by what always happens to fiat currencies, that is inflation. The fact that the U.S. government at some point down the road, and I'm not going to exactly predict when, but at some point down the road, will now be able to pay its debts without massively inflating the money supply, which would cause a complete devaluation of fiat currencies. But fiat currencies have survived a lot. You know, they've survived the inflation of the 70s. They've survived many monetary crises around the world. But the dollar has survived in spite of all of that. And I think what it will take for the downfall of the dollar is downfall of the U.S. economy. And we're heading towards that if we don't do something about the amount of debt, the amount of regulation, the amount of control we have on the U.S. economy. We have to free up the U.S. economy. And we have to stop spending like there's no tomorrow. And notice I didn't say anything about taxes. You know, I don't believe the solution is lowering taxes. The solution is slashing spending. And until we have a politician who's willing to do that, and we don't today, in either party, we're in deep trouble. We're in deep trouble because we're digging ourselves deeper and deeper and deeper into a hole, which the outcome of which ultimately is fiat currency disappearance, and then what replaces it. And I don't think a situation like that of a financial catastrophe, financial cataclysm, that the solution is going to be crypto, because I don't think people will trust crypto. I think the element of trust will not be there. I think in a real financial crisis, people will gravitate towards gold. They'll gravitate towards real assets. They'll gravitate towards real stuff that cannot be taken away from them, and stuff that cannot be turned off for them. So stuff that is not dependent on the electric grid. So when disaster comes, people are going to want physical assets. Crypto is going to serve an important function in any advanced economy, particularly in a mixed economy, where because of government regulations, government controls, for example, moving money is very difficult, particularly across state lines, is very difficult. Cryptocurrency solves those problems. It makes it cheaper. It makes it easier. It makes it smoother. Cryptocurrency can also be used for a variety of blockchain applications. But I do not think that cryptocurrencies is going to be ultimately the alternative currency to fiat, and is not going to replace fiat currencies. I think gold will replace fiat currencies, and crypto will serve a marginal role within a gold-based economy, and that marginal role will have to do with efficiency. I ultimately think that crypto will, they'll find a way to have crypto based on gold, and that there will always be an advantage to a money that is physical, that a money that has a physical reality to it. But as I said, I think blockchain technology is incredibly valuable. There's a lot to be invested. There's a lot of money to be made in there. It's still very early. All of its applications are still to be determined, but it's an exciting field. All right. Let's see. Let's take insider trading. And then I think I'm going to call it afternoon. Keep the show a little shorter than usual. And tomorrow, I want to talk about the Me Too movement and anything else you guys want to talk about. So, and by the way, you can still ask me. I'm always open to Super Chat questions. I always like dollar signs. Supplementing Patreon with YouTube is great, but the amount of money you get from YouTube is pittance. And the only thing that makes YouTube interesting is the Super Chat. And even the Super Chat, you know, might generate a few hundred dollars a month. But a few hundred dollars a month add up, it adds up, so it makes a difference. So thank you for those of you who participate in the Super Chat, and keep doing it. And you can do it today if there's some burning question that you have. All right, let's take this on from a Super Chat question, I think, from yesterday that I promised to answer today. Can you explain what insider trading is, how it should be thought about in terms of free markets and individual rights? Great question. I've actually done a short video on this. There's a section, I think, in my In Defense of Financial Markets course that is available for free on iTunes and on any podcasting app where I talk about this. It's the Defense of Financial Markets at some point will also be available on YouTube, in audio only, unfortunately, but it will be available. I think it's a seven lecture course on financial markets, and I talk about insider trading there. So let's talk about what insider trading is. Let me first say, before I say what insider trading is, that it's really hard to say what insider trading is because the law is purposefully ambiguous about what insider trading is. So it's one of those non-objective laws that doesn't clearly define what insider trading is. So what happens with a lot of insider trading legal cases is that they go to trial and it could go either way. And the trial court might decide it one way, and then the appellate court, you always want to appeal an insider trading case because many, many, many insider trading cases have been reversed on appeal. All right. So it's a confusing legal issue because it's purposefully non-objective and ill-defined. So what is insider trading? Broadly speaking, it's the idea that you should never trade on information that is not publicly available to everybody else. That is, the idea is an egalitarian idea. It's the idea that trading should only happen based on information that is available to everybody. Everybody. So everybody has a chance to trade on the new information about a particular company, a particular stock. You should never have an advantage in the trading. Okay. So let's take some examples of what they mean. And let's start from the more, I don't know, legally complex ones to the legally simple ones, at least under the regime we live in today. And then I want to talk about what it would look like in a free market. So for example, if you work for a printer and I don't know, a press release comes across your desk from company A and vis-a-vis a printer, right? Vis-a-vis your job as a printer. Because I don't know, they're printing them up to hand out to shareholders. And it's brand new information about the company. Nobody knows except the people involved in making the press release. And of course, the people at the company involved in making the press release are not allowed to trade on this new information. And you see it and you trade on that information. Let's say it says, the press release says, we've just had a major financial fraud, and we're going to have to take a huge write down, and the company's worth much less than what we thought it was worth. And you short the stock. You bet on the stock going down because it's going to go down as soon as this information becomes public. Is that legal or isn't it? Well, probably if you're the printer working for the company, it's illegal. It's illegal. You have a fiduciary duty to your client not to trade on this information. And the law would probably say if you traded on it, it's inside information. If you called up your brother-in-law and said, hey, I've got some information, you should trade on it, you probably broke the law. Did your brother-in-law break the law by listening to you? Maybe, maybe not. Not clear. Not obvious. If you came across this press release, I don't know, by accident, because it was in the trash can. A previous version of it, before it was finalized, was in the trash can that had all the relevant information. And you happen to glance at it and see it, not as part of your job, can you trade on it then? Ambiguous. If you paid somebody at the printing shop, then clearly it's against the law. If you paid somebody to break into the printing shop, that's the situation, by the way, in Wall Street, in the movie Wall Street. Clearly against the law, clearly objectively against the law. The break-in is against the law. If you produce the information as a company executive, against the law. You cannot, as an executive, trade on your knowledge about the company unless that knowledge is publicly available to everybody. Okay, so that's what insider trading is. Right? Now, why does it exist? Partially because of an egalitarian philosophy that says we should all be the same. Now, partially it's because, you know, it makes some economic moral sense. For example, you don't want a CEO to be able to, in a sense, trade and then, let's say, sell the stock and then do something bad to cause the stock price to go down because he can benefit from it going down, then buy it cheaper and stuff, right? So you want to be able to control the CEO because I would argue that doing that would constitute fraud. The idea is that if somebody buys the stock before the good news is coming, then they've taken advantage of the person who's selling the stock because you who are buying the stock have the inside information and the other person doesn't. So it really comes from an egalitarian perspective and from the perspective of we should all have the same information, the perspective of if I buy the stock and it goes up in the future and you sell the stock and it goes up in the future, you lost somehow. Now, I think that's perverse. You're selling the stock based on the best available information to you, based on your knowledge, based on your information. You don't have all the information. Nobody does. And my view is markets should allow for insider trading. Now, I'll give you the exceptions in a minute. Or put it another way. Put markets aside for a minute. There is no violation of rights in insider trading. The only violation of rights in insider trading is the fiduciary duty of management to trade on inside information when it is harmful to shareholders. And if that's the case, shareholders should sue management. You don't need a law for that. And indeed, I think in a free market, shareholders would contractually obligate managers to only trade in certain ways at certain times in order to avoid these kind of conflicts of interest between the manager as a shareholder and the manager as a manager. And there are all kinds of ways that you can do away with those conflicts of interest through contracts. You don't need a law. You don't need a law. The whole issue of managers trading on inside information is the relationship between the managers and shareholders. If shareholders don't care, why do I? Why does the government? See, the only standard for government action is it protecting individual rights? Well, there's no violation of individual rights here. There's a contractual relationship between shareholders and managers, and they get to decide the terms under which managers should be allowed to trade on inside information. There's an argument to be made that when it comes to good news, managers should be allowed to trade in inside information. Because as they buy stock because of expected good news in the future, the stock price gets embedded with that information because they drive, as they buy the stock, they drive the cost, the price of that stock up. And therefore, the stock now is more efficiently priced. And having an efficient stock price is good for the economy. It's good for shareholders because the price is now truly reflective of the best information about the company. And it's great for the allocation of capital across the economy. Now, again, if you need more time to digest this, I recommend my course on financial markets, which is available, again, on any podcasting app, where I go into a lot more detail in how stock markets allocate capital and the importance of stock prices, why it's so important for stock prices to be efficient, to be properly priced, to reflect the true value of the company, and therefore to embed the best information possible. Insider trading allows you to embed that best information possible. So, you know, my view is if you want to restrict insider trading, you do it contractually. If you don't, then don't. The government has no business in it. If a printer, the decision about whether a printer should trade on inside information should be a contractual between the printer and the company for whom he's doing the printing. If a stranger comes across a piece of information, of course they should be allowed to trade on. And of course, this raises a huge amount of questions. What if I discover new information? For example, what if I'm really good at research and I do really, really, really intense research about a particular company and I really, really figure stuff out that nobody else knows? Am I then required to let the world know, or can I go ahead and trade on it? It's ambiguous a little bit, right? With research, generally, the courts say, no, you can trade on it. But what if part of my research, I interviewed managers? And just from their body language, I interpret it in a particular way. You can't trade on that. So I asked them, are you having any financial difficulties? And they kind of squirmed in their chairs. And they gave the answer that they give everybody else, but I could see them squirming in the chair. And that gave me additional information. Am I then allowed to trade on it? And the answer is no. I, for example, as a hedge fund manager today, when I meet with managers of companies I might invest in, I have to disclose that to my compliance officer. I have to tell them exactly what I learned from the meeting, how I learned it, and if I got any information from the meeting that might constitute non-public, what's called non-public material information, I have to then not trade that stock. That's what my compliance officer tells me. And that's the law. And I follow the law because the last thing I want is the SEC after me, right? But notice that that takes away, I have real information. I know something. And I can't trade on it. That takes away information from the market. It takes away information from my ability to trade. It takes away profits from me and my clients. It's awful. It's stupid. It's wrong. And it's not the government's business. Now, let's say one of the arguments is if people were allowed to trade on inside information, a lot of people wouldn't trade. Like Joe Schmo. I don't know who Joe Schmo is. But anyway, the common investor who doesn't have access to special information would be afraid to enter the markets because the assumption he would have is anybody I'm trading with has more information than me. Uh-oh, I'm in trouble. I don't want to trade with people who have more information with me because I'm getting screwed. I'm being taken advantage of. Donald Trump's field day, right? It's a trade in which I'm losing because they have more information than I, which is true. So my answer to that is twofold. One, okay, so they won't trade. It's not like there's a God-given right that everybody gets to trade in the market with equal information, knowledge, ability, brains, responsibility, control of emotion. I mean, there are lots of reasons why some have advantages over others in trading and securities in the markets. It's why we trade, because we disagree. It's why we trade, because we have different perspectives. But yeah, some people trade stupidly. But, you know, what can you do? Some people trade because they're geniuses. Warren Buffett, let's say. So one is, you know, that'll be it. And maybe there'll be fewer traders. Maybe fewer people will trade in the markets. Why is that a bad thing? Too many people today are in stocks, I believe. They don't understand stocks. They don't know anything about the stock market. They don't know what they're doing in the stock market. They're in there because everybody else is in there and they think they can, but they can't outsmart the markets. Every time you, as an amateur, go into the stock market buying and selling stocks, you should assume the people you're trading with have more knowledge, information, knowledge of the area than you do. It's just a given. That's why I've always recommended that people who don't know what they're doing, which is 90% of people, should buy index funds, should just diversify. The second option is, the second possibility is, that if it really is a problem that volume would dry up, that investors would exit the market, that would people would not trade because of the fear of inside information, then exchanges could impose inside information rules. Like the New York Stock Exchange could have one set of rules about inside information. The NASDAQ could have another set of information. The Philadelphia Exchange could have a different set. London, Tokyo, Frankfurt, could each one of those exchanges could have different insider trading rules. And let's see which rules make sense. It's like my view of accounting standards. I don't think there should be one accounting standard for all companies. And I certainly don't think the government should dictate what the accounting standard should be. Competition should. Different companies should try to report their, or exchanges should try to report companies listed on their exchange with different standards. And let's see which one makes more sense. By let's see which one makes more money. By letting see which one has more trading happen on it. And I don't know what rules make sense. There is no platonic answer to what insider trading rules make the most sense. That's the beauty of markets. Let's experiment. Let's test it. The key is that since there is no violation of rights, there is no expectation. There should be no expectation of equal information. There should never be expectation of equal information or equal ability or equal knowledge. The government has no job, should have no laws with regard to insider trading, and let the market solve the problem. if there is a problem. And I think we'd probably come up with solutions that we can't imagine, and criteria that we can't even imagine, and models that we can't imagine. I think generally, we don't have great imaginations until we face a problem that needs solving. And that's why markets work so well. People engage with their creativity, their ingenuity in problem solving when there's a problem to be solved, not when it's theoretical, but when it's real. I mean, yeah, you can engage it in theory as well, right? Obviously, but the beauty of in the marketplace is you've got lots of people trying out different solutions to a problem, and let the best solution win. Best solution win. So that's my view of insider trading. It should be legal. And then exchanges and corporations and investors should then experiment with different types of contractual relationships to solve whatever problems might exist as a consequence of insider trading. Okay. Now, as I said, some insider trading is fraud, and only that type of insider trading should be banned. And that's when managers, do things that are against shareholders' interest in order to benefit themselves. All right. I am going to call it a day. We've gone for now in 10 minutes. That's a pretty good time frame. Unless there's a quick super chat question, I will entertain super chat questions right now. I will remind you that we'll have another show in tomorrow. And also encourage you to share the shows. Also, you know, I'm putting up a ton of talks. I don't know if you guys like my talks, but if you do, then please share them. They're not getting huge numbers of views, and I think it's because people are not sharing them. And you've probably seen a lot of these talks because I published them earlier on different platforms. So please share them on my platform, because that's how I'll get more subscribers. Go listen to them. Some of my talks, some of these talks are worth listening to more than once. There's some really good ones that are bringing, you know, morality of war, which a lot of you probably haven't heard in a long, long time. There's a lot of talks on inequality that I just put up. There's a lot of good stuff. So go and look at the channel. There's I've got playlists. I've got a playlist for lectures, a playlist for debates, a playlist for interviews. You can catch all the stuff I do on those playlists. And what else? I think that's it. I think other than that, don't forget to make a contribution on Patreon. Don't forget to subscribe to my channel. Don't forget to share. And there's a lot. If somebody says there's a lot of repetition, it's absolutely true. There's a lot of repetition in my lectures because every time I give the same lecture, I put it up as a video. So yeah, skip the ones that are the same. Although, every time I do these lectures, they come out a little differently. By the way, I'm going to be putting up my Brazil lectures, and those are different. Some of it's the same. Some of the concretes I use are the same. But the context and the format is different. So I'm hoping you'll enjoy those. Those are going to be up. Okay, tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, I will start off tomorrow with a discussion of Me Too. And then we'll see where we take it. Also, if you have questions, and if you want to ask questions on the Super Chat, feel free to do that. I might also comment on some of the news stuff that's been happening in the last 2 weeks since I was in Brazil and haven't commented on. But I want to, you know, but let's focus on Me Too and other questions. So let people know, come on live, ask Super Chat questions, and everything's cool. All right. Thanks, everybody. Have a great, I guess it's Saturday. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Tomorrow is Sunday. Talk to you then. Bye, everybody.